positive, supportive manner. And the real question is whether the multilingual interpreters picked up on that either. We're going to start. Yeah, they turned this on. They turned this on, Mark. Okay.
I think people will wander in for this program. We are sadly competing with Vint Cerf and lunch. And I think that we're just going to have to see whether a discussion about actually finding a way to move to a resolution of some of the problems that companies have operating globally is of enough concern as discussing the problem. My name is Leslie Harris. I'm the president of the Center for Democracy and Technology, which is an internet policy and civil liberties group that operates out of Washington, D.C. For the last, it's now year and a half, there has been an interesting process going on. That tries to move beyond what I think is a fairly ample discussion, both at IGF and in many other forums, of the problems that companies face and the problematic responses that companies often engage in when confronted with privacy and free expression challenges from countries around the world. This multi-stakeholder process, which in a year and a half we have not been able to come up with a clever name for, naming rights are still available, grew out of several different efforts over the last year. One, a group of academics led by the Berkman Center at Harvard, the Oxford Institute, Internet Institute, and several different departments in Berkeley, started to work on a sort of model code for companies. At the same time, the companies were working with Business for Social Responsibility, which is an umbrella corporate social responsibility group, to start looking at what such a set of principles or code might look like. And at the same time, my organization was beginning to convene stakeholders from human rights groups, from social investors, academics, and companies, with a goal first of seeing whether we could have a useful discussion around these issues, but in the back of our mind with the hope that it might turn eventually into a process for developing global corporate principles. About a year ago, this process in fact moved from being sort of a loose discussion, and these different processes came together in a much more formal way to see if we could draft a set of principles on privacy and free expression that would help the ICT sector be positive actors when they are responding to challenges, and they are ample in democratic countries as well as repressive ones. Calls for censorship, participation in access to personal data, sometimes in circumstances where
closer your microphone.
Human rights are involved. I want to emphasize that the goal is global corporate principles, and they are not principles aimed at any particular country. And indeed, coming from the United States, I am eager for companies to develop and execute a set of principles that will lead them to question some of the requests of my government more forcefully. So for a year and a half, the Center for Democracy and Technology and Business for Social Responsibility has been facilitating this process. The companies involved include Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, Vodafone, Telesonera out of Sweden, and most recently French Telecom has joined the group. The human rights groups involved include Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, Human Rights in China. There are key social investment funds, Calvert, FNC, Trillium. There are key free expression groups, World Press Freedom, Internews, Reporters Without Borders. It's important to understand that there is a formal agreement that frames us, and it includes confidentiality. So I'm going to be able to describe what our thinking is at this point, but I'm not going to be able to give out the draft. It's also important to understand that the participants in the process are committed to engaging in good faith to come to agreement, but nobody is committed either to the draft as it now stands or necessarily to become an endorser and participant long term. I sometimes describe, and I stole this phrase from my colleague Steve over here, that what we're trying to achieve in this multi-stakeholder process is a set of guiding principles that help the companies act in the space between compliance and defiance. And that doesn't mean that we're taking defiance off the table in particular instances, but on a daily basis, what are the activities they ought to be engaging in that help them better respond to these challenges that they're facing all around the world. I'll also say that a lot has been achieved by the dialogue alone among these parties who, frankly, until this process began, not had very fruitful discussions. It's been extraordinarily frank, and I will also say that the companies have told this group things that I'm quite surprised and pleased by the openness. We really do understand that a level that might surprise all of you, actually what they're doing in some countries. And I'm also very pleased that given the diversity of the groups that are in the room, that confidentiality has been maintained. It's made this process possible, and you can well imagine what a breach would do in that circumstance. I want to introduce the panelists. Before I do, I want to say that I intend to completely depart from a traditional United Nations protocol, which means that we are not going to have long opening statements from our panelists. I'm going to pose a set of questions that come out of this principles process, urge discussion among our panelists, and as quickly as is feasible, try to turn this into a discussion between the folks up here and people in the audience, some of whose organizations are in fact participating in this process and probably also have something to say. So I see that I'm introducing it in order different, but I'll just do it the way I have it. Mark Bench, who is the executive director of the World Press Freedom Committee, I think you all know, is an international umbrella organization that includes 45 journalistic groups over six continents that are united in the defense and promotion of press freedom in all media. Bob Borstin, and you know, we've been working together forever, and I think I never get your title right. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And I'm just going to, you know, as I say, take judicial notice of the fact that I believe you all know what Google is and that I do not need to describe it. Rob Ferris, poor Rob, we've had him on every panel having vaguely to do with this issue for 2 days, who is the research director at Harvard Law School's OpenNet Initiative. The OpenNet Initiative is a collaborative partnership of four leading academic institutions, the Citizen Lab at University of Toronto, the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard, the Advanced Network Research Group at Cambridge, and the Oxford Internet Institute. And OpenNet is a project which aims to investigate, expose, and analyze internet filtering surveillance practices in a credible and nonpartisan fashion, and they do so wonderfully. Steve Del Bianco, do I pronounce that right?
Sure do.
You know, I never had to say it out loud, is the executive director of NetChoice. NetChoice is a coalition of trade associations that includes international e-commerce businesses, online consumer, who share the goal of promoting convenience, choice, and commerce on the net. Members include AOL, eBay, MySpace, Oracle, VeriSign, and Yahoo. Yahoo, the only one of those who is currently a member of this process, like to include the others over time. Let me just broadly describe, without going into the substance, how these principles are structured, and then put out some opening questions for this panel. Apparently loudly, since you may not be able to hear it, but somebody is literally speaking in my ear. So there are three main substantive sections to these principles. One, a set of commitments around free expression. Second, a set of commitments around privacy and protecting consumers' right to privacy when there are data requests. Third, a section on developing and implementing responsible corporate practices, which really has to do with how you take these principles and make them real throughout varying aspects of a company. There are also two other sections which I would say are the work in process and perhaps the most difficult part, and that is will be very clear commitments on accountability and assessment and an ongoing multi-stakeholder governance process to in an iterative fashion, improve the principles, review and help companies improve their performance, reach out to other stakeholders and involve them in the process. We're still, I think, working on that. Let me begin, before I get into some of the specific substantive areas, by putting out a question that I'm going to go to Rob on to put this issue in context, which is really, why are we here? Why are we seeing companies being put essentially in the crossfire by countries that they operate in, that who are enlisting them, whether it's by law, by regulation, or sheer coercion, to assist in or become the primary actors in censorship and other human rights violations? How did we get here?
Can I borrow this one?
Absolutely.
Sure. Pleasure to be here. I'll start with just a couple minutes on the context, one being that we're seeing a rise in content restrictions around the world. There's three dozen governments, at least, that have significant restrictions on internet content from a variety of ways, be it filtering or takedowns or threats and intimidation or surveillance. There's many more. Every country around the world is debating this, if not applying restrictions at this point. And I think it's also safe to say that every country and society and culture around the world is struggling with this. On one side, you have the political urge to rid the internet of everything that's ugly or criminal. On the other side, the means to take these things away from the internet would have profound influences upon freedom of speech, on privacy, and freedom of assembly. There's a couple things about the internet which strike me that are different from previous censorship regimes that lead us to where we are now. One is the everything is everywhere phenomenon. Previous censorship regimes varied a lot by location and by medium and by topic. You could have one censorship regime that applied to newsstands in New York City, whereas movie theaters in Louisiana or in Durban or in London had another regime. The problem with the internet now is that the stakes are much higher. To the extent that removing content from the internet is successful, it removes it everywhere or not. And that's one of the problems with it. The other problem is the profusion of information. If I was the librarian in charge of upholding community standards, I had a flow of books coming into the library which I could evaluate. Censors who are charged, whether they do so readily or not, whether they're willing or feel it's a good idea, have a tremendous amount of information to look at, and it's an impossible load. And what this means is that you're probably going to want to delegate this to somebody else. The other problem is, who's going to decide what website, what application, what community is appropriate or not? So you have another delegation problem there, which has a sense of absoluteness. Where is the I know it if I see it aspect here? And for that, I think it's fairly obvious why a lot of governments have turned to technology companies, because the governments don't want to have a public list of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. That would be a very, very difficult political situation to be in. Hence, we turn to the technology companies to say, you're going to have to uphold these standards for us. Thank you very much. If you don't, we'll hold you to task.
Thanks. Another question that I think is sort of a framing question for this discussion is this process, which we view as a not just social responsibility process towards principles, but a human rights process, because it is a process that one of the agreements is to root these agreements in traditional human rights norms and laws. But, you know, I guess one question that's come up a lot in this process is how is trying to develop a set of corporate principles similar or different from the other top issues that try to reconcile the interests of government, of civil society, and business? I mean, if you look back to efforts from the Sullivan principles in South Africa to more recent agreements on fair labor, extractive industries, you know, there are some sort of, I think, unique challenges here. On the other hand, there are some ways that it's all the same. Who wants to take that? Steve, you want to give it? And then I'm going to go to Mark.
Thanks, Leslie.
And to answer your question about the difference, I would probably say that when you compare it to other conflicts where government, business, and civil society had a conflict about something, there may have been some stickiness to the status quo. And I think in this case, there's very little stickiness about the status quo in the sense that neither businesses nor civil society are satisfied with the way it's working today. There may be some governments that are quite satisfied, but you can be sure that the parties that are doing the real negotiating on this document are not satisfied. And I think to help explain sort of why, I just want to share one metaphor, because anytime you do meetings at ICANN or at IGF, it's really important to use a soccer football metaphor. And I really think of it this way. The providers of my members, providers of email, hosting services, blogs, and then social networking sites, we're really like soccer coaches, right? And the consumers, our customers, they're the players in the team, and the governments, of course, are the referees. And the coach, which is the companies, we want our players to go as aggressively as they can to play with real passion out there, or paixão, as they say here, I guess, in Brazil, without bringing a whistle or a red card. And the thing is that the referees, they just sort of make things up as they go along. They don't actually give us a clear set of rules. You think soccer has rules. Try figuring out what a persistent infringement is, or the difference between dangerous play and aggressive play, or a high kick, sort of like what China calls revealing state secrets, right? It's hard to figure out. So these principles that we're talking about here, it's like a playbook. It's like a playbook for the coach and for the players that we can use to know, how do we argue that call? How aggressively am I going to jump in the referee's face and argue that call and push back? Or better still, appeal the call after it's been made, and over the long run, work to change the rules so that we get to play a more aggressive game in the future.
Thanks. Mark, do you want to comment on this as a free expression group?
Having worked with this organization, that is this multi-stakeholder process, I've been very impressed, again, as Leslie mentioned, I've been very impressed with the openness with which the entire process has occurred. The openness of the companies, of the investors, of the NGOs, the human rights organizations have proceeded. Some people may say, what's in this for the companies? Why would they agree to submit themselves to this kind of a thing? They have much to benefit from it. They have employees abroad and locally. I mean, they have employees all over the place, and they need help in setting standards, and they're happy to accept them for the most part. Also, they're just as the green movement may not pay off immediately for companies that are doing that sort of thing or who wish to, but in the long run, it benefits everyone. And in the meantime, they get good PR out of it. But I'm convinced from having worked with them, and only briefly, but having worked with them, that they're not just doing this to be seen as being green, but to find solutions and to be able to have a code of ethics and a code of they will work by these standards and go to governments and say this is how we're going to be functioning. And I think it will be useful for everyone, users, coaches, players, everyone.
Bob, do you want to comment on that from a company that obviously has to think about this a lot?
Is this working?
No.
What this one is.
Okay. I will echo what technology. Mark says and say that I think he made some very valid points there about why we are involved with this. We need help internally in addition to externally. So that our folks know what kinds of principles and guidelines they should be following when making really hard decisions, because we do face this kind of thing every day. I wanted to add one more reason why we're participating, and that, of course, is masochism. You know, we really enjoy this on a fundamental level.
And be rewarded as well.
Right. There is reward for those who stay with it. So let me try to get more specifically into sort of what kinds of commitments this draft is asking companies to make. For example, and actually the commitments on the free expression side and on the privacy side are similar, although not exactly the same. The principles would say, for example, when you get a demand, if you're in a circumstance that you are forced to comply, you should narrowly construe. You should be reviewing the risk to users in the communities that you're in and taking specific steps based on human rights risk in the area you're in. You should aggressively negotiate. Now, again, we understand there are places where these are operational principles tomorrow and places where this may be aspirational, but it is to put everybody on the same page. When you are in high risk of circumstances, if it is possible to challenge legally or to enlist the support or help of human rights actors or home governments, you should do so. You should seek jurisdictional limitations, and I think if this is controversial in the group for some interesting reasons which we can draw out, but if you are forced to negotiate a limitation, you should be looking to do it in the narrowest jurisdictional way possible. And I think Google is an example because they don't tend to have their content servers in the country. The demand is always to take things down for the world. How do you avoid that? How do you do that narrowly? How are you entirely transparent with users? Google has taken some key steps here, but I think that these principles push beyond the general, it's because of the government, to help educate users exactly who is demanding this, under what circumstances, and what the laws are in the country, because users do not necessarily know. And on the data side, to be far more transparent to users about what those risks are. One commitment that I find that I'm particularly pleased with, but it's perhaps because I am a public policy advocate, is there is a strong commitment in the draft principles for these companies to engage in public policy and to collaborate with the other stakeholders in international and national arenas to try to further privacy and free expression on the internet. I will just say, as an advocate in the United States who works closely with companies, that I will say that when the time comes to put your name on the hard document arguing for pushback, even in the United States and even in companies that I work very closely with, we often hide behind our trade associations or are very happy that my organization exists. And frankly, the difference between having the names of major companies on those legal challenges and policy documents cannot be overstated. So that is one commitment that I have to say I'm surprised we have, but we do have. There's also, I think, a very strong commitment to be a positive actor, particularly in the content area, to make sure any content that's not available directly inside a country is mirrored and available in many other places, and a commitment to be part of the positive force to help people through technology and other factors to be able both to protect their anonymity and make content available in other ways. On the privacy side, I'd say one of the key challenges that continues, and Julien is sitting in the front of the room, no way I could avoid expressing this and forcing my group to discuss it, is the question of data. And while the principals, I think, pretty forcefully urge the companies to engage in serious human rights risk assessment, and we'll get back to what that means in a minute, and develop their data and data retention policies accordingly, unless they're in the EU, where they now have data retention mandates. What it doesn't do, and I think what a lot of the human rights groups would like to see happen, is that we move beyond that to a commitment to keep personal information out of high-risk companies. And that remains, I think, a challenging issue in this process, and it's one that I'd like to have the panel talk a little bit about, as to whether or not, one, that is feasible. Now, I know Google actually does that. But two, what degree of protection does that commitment give? I don't think there's anybody in this process who thinks it's absolute. So I kind of wasn't sure I was going to bring this question up. I will turn it to Google, who actually has content out of the country, and how much has that helped you in responding to challenges, as compared to keeping that in the country when you have requests?
Give me a microphone.
He just looks too puzzled for me.
I'm slightly puzzled, but not wholly.
Puzzled?
I think it does help that we maintain Google.com even when we have country-specific services. And that's something that most people, I don't think, know. So, for example, in China, we have Google.cn, but Google.com is still available, albeit with some difficulty there. But, for example, in certain European countries that ban certain things, you can still find your way onto Google.com and find those sites. So the content is available despite national laws that prevent that content from being there, which sounds like a combination of a difficult circumstance and violating national laws, I suppose. Sorry? But it's a very tricky thing with an international mode such as the internet and the kind of content that we put on it. I think that, therefore, what we're doing is promoting freedom of expression and, as I've said before to many of the people in this room, access to information, which I think is a very, very important part of this. It's not only freedom of people to express themselves, but it's also who can find what on the internet when they want to find it, which is the flip side as I see it.
So that was a great answer, but I asked a different question. So my different question was about personal data. I'm sorry, Bob. And about personally identified information about users in countries that are high risk. Of course, I now believe the U.S. is becoming high risk, but I'm making some non-neutral editorial comments about my home country. But as I said, one of the controversies, no, you get to speak later. You used up your turn answering the wrong question.
The clock's running.
Right, but I think the question, and I guess I'm curious from Steve's perspective, I'm also curious from World Press, what your thinking is. It is a strong view, I think, of the human rights participants in this process, and I did send an email inviting anybody who was participating in the process to be on the panel. So those of you who are in the room and not on the panel, feel free to sort of bootstrap yourself in here, that a commitment to keep data out is a key commitment, and it's not one we have. We have a commitment to take steps in mitigation, which could include that. But these are not binary principles as a general matter. They are not yes, no, good, bad, and they're not because we're dealing with so many different types of companies, different business models, and perhaps even different regulatory regimes. For those of you who just came in, we have internet companies, we also have telecommunications companies, and in some countries the regulatory regime is different and the telecom providers are still operating under different laws. And so these have been the challenges, I think, of responding to what I personally have some sympathy with, which is, why do you why are you keeping your data in X country? So I'm going to ask Steve to respond, and then I'm going to make Julianne answer from the floor, because this is, as I said, this is a conversation. This is not a traditional panel. For those of you who came in, I said I was going to violate all UN norms. We were not going to have talking heads, and we were not going to have a formal panel.
Thank you. The beauty of the principles as they're articulated is they don't rely on any one tactic as the silver bullet that's going to solve this problem. So, for instance, you brought up, for the purposes of your question, and I now know it's very important to answer your question.
Thank you.
I understand. The notion of moving data offshore. So let's not get too focused on that, because we honestly don't know. This needs to be a dynamic set of principles, and the governments involved are a moving target. There may be situations where the data offshore sufficiently protects the identity.
Yeah. We were enjoying the little burbling sounds from the back. I'm sorry, Steve.
There will be situations where the data...
We're family friendly.
That's okay.
And I can't wait to hear, Bob discuss some of the situations that they've had, where if the identity is stored in servers that aren't in country, is that sufficient to protect it? And if that turns out to be sufficient to protect it, how long will that be sufficient until governments do find a way to reach past that with new means and mechanisms? Because I think that even though the human rights groups are the experts here, what we want to remember is that the customers are the objects. You see, because human rights is about customers, right? All the customers are human, and the customer is always right. And we are therefore completely focused on keeping those guys happy. There's too much of this notion that a company is motivated entirely by what, shareholder interest, stakeholder interest? Shareholder is somewhere four levels deep on the Maslow hierarchy. When we go into a country to do business, the first thing we need to do is take care of customers, grow that top line of number of customers, number of eyeballs, number of minutes they spend on our blog sites, looking at our email, bringing up sites, because that's where the revenue comes from on an internet-based business model. So taking care of customers means making sure that their data is protected in any of a variety of ways. And what I love about the document so far is it's full of verbs, the whole section about protecting privacy, requesting that the domestic legal processes are followed, challenging the government authorities, interpret the authority narrowly. And those are the kind of verbs that are right on the line of giving us the guidance we need to protect that information.
Julianne, do you want to talk about this briefly? Because I will say that the data, this one issue is the one where we move from general principles, of which one strategy might be keeping your data offshore, to an actual mandate. And I think it's where one of the reasons we're stuck. I think it's important to put this notion on the table.
Yeah. Just wanted to say first that of course I support the process generally, and there are very good points.
Your name
about
is
transparency and everything. I won't talk about that because that's been discussed before, so I'm going to be the critical guy.
You may be
as usual, I guess.
Yeah. As we say, we all have our roles.
Why this process starts? It started...
Introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm Julian.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, Julian. I work for I'm here representative for the World Press Freedom Committee, and I've been following the process for quite a while. Why this process starts at first? Because of the Shitao case. Because Yahoo took so much heat after Shitao was jailed in China, because Yahoo handed over information to the Chinese police. That's exactly why we're here and why the process started, because of this very case. Because so far there was issues with censorship, but nobody thought that was enough to start this kind of code of conduct. So it started with Shitao case. And the question is, could Shitao be jailed in exactly the same way after this code of conduct has been adopted? The answer is yes.
Yeah, I think we.
Okay,
would,
so
I think we would concede that, because
yeah,
we don't believe
and that's
the government
why I
has
think
a final action.
But that's why I think where the data is located is very important. And I think if the process wants to be successful, you have to explain basically, let's say clearly, to Yahoo that being part of this process has a cost, and the cost is to pull their servers out of China. I know they have a deal with Alibaba, it's gonna be hard for them, but this kind of human rights process has a cost. and even the financial cost. And as long as the companies don't accept to assume these financial costs, that will be cosmetic. And I'm glad Google is here, and it's I would say easy for Google, because I mean Google is already assuming taking responsibilities for many things. They don't have their servers in China, and I think it's great not to have done that. So I think unless Yahoo agrees to discuss about where their servers are located, then I won't be happy with the whole process.
Let me ask a question, and I'm looking over at Bertrand, because I think it would be useful to have some other people in the audience who have been, you know, in government in a serious way around information, about whether that is a practical solution, what we might worry about in terms of, here's my concern. Everybody takes their server out of China, or they take it out of Vietnam, or they, you know, take it out of the United States. And the next day, a law gets passed in those countries that simply says, and, you know, I'm looking at the EU because, you know, we've been fending off data retention in the United States, and it's simply become harder because of what the EU has done. How realistic it is for a public process to say, when we do a human rights assessment, we will keep your data out and be able to hold to that. I mean, I want to hear from people in government. I mean, you know, I'm expressing what my concern is as a person who, you know, fights in the policy fields every day. Do you want to grab a mic and respond? Anybody else with a government I would love to hear from. But.
Thanks, Leslie. Yeah, I'm Bertrand Lachapelle. I'm with the French government. I'm the special envoy for the information society and dealing with internet governance issues in general and the post-WSIS thing. I actually spent the whole WSIS process in civil society. I've been the co-founder of a company, so I'm somewhat of a multi-stakeholder wrapped in one, if you want. Okay, no, the answer to this is actually piggybacking on what Steve was mentioning about the referee notion. I don't agree with the referee notion in this domain. I don't think the separation of the different constituencies is a correct answer to the kind of problem we're facing. We're here at the IGF in something that is supposed to implement or at least invent a multi-stakeholder approach, and multi-stakeholder approach is getting against the silo mentality. I've been advocating within ICANN, for instance, to break down the silo mentality between the GAC, the GNSO, and all the others on certain issues. Here is even more necessary. The fact that it's a moving target is because the governments themselves are struggling with finding the appropriate tools. There are good ones, there are bad ones, and even the good ones are behaving badly, and even the bad ones have right reasons sometimes to do what they do. The key question is, how do you establish mechanisms that are traceable, transparent, and that you can log basically what people do? If people are tampering with something, and there is something that logs what they're doing, they will be exposed to monitoring, criticism, and so on. If you don't engage the governments in the kind of exercises that you're talking about, you and them will have a problem, because the enforceability and an implementation of the kind of codes of conduct that you're discussing is harder. I'm just coming out of the workshop on the Bill of Rights. And the key notion I got out of this session is basically that it is not about framing or establishing new principles necessarily in documents.
No, I'm glad to hear that.
It's about producing tool sets, instruments, very concrete instruments to implement and enforce some of the provisions that exist. And the tool set can be designed with the good-willing governments, even if sometimes they are taking bad measures. So I think engaging them, even in the processes that you're doing, might be useful for everybody.
Yeah, and I think the question of beginning to engage governments is one that we are just moving to be able to know that we have a group in order to do that. But I am curious about what your thoughts are on data before you disappear. On the ability of companies to make a sort of policy decision to keep their data out of a country. And
well, the thing is, I don't want to open the debate, but it's interesting to see the kind of problems that Google was facing with the ORCID thing with Brazil. The question of moving data out of the country is an element of answer, but it's not a long-lasting answer, because either you're going to hop from one country to the next as it's chased by different regulations, And in any case, you will always be faced, I mean, companies will be faced with the threat of one government to basically cut the whole activity in the country, which is just a nuclear bomb threat. So the key question is the framework defining an envelope of viability? I mean, Google, Bob was mentioning yesterday in the Freedom of Expression Coalition, the notion of making compromises and having to deal. I strongly believe that individual company dealing with individual governments will always have a harder time establishing a compromise in a good position.
Which is definitely one of the reasons of trying to develop a collective response.
And I think that this IGF is a very good opportunity to aggregate critical mass of actors. I mean, of course, even the US government, the European governments, and other countries do not have exactly the same positions. They don't have the same position on privacy issues. I mean, we are struggling with the WHOIS case in ICANN for ages, or hate speech, or a lot of things. The key question, and there was just a mention on the Convention on Cybercrime, and an example, they were talking about minimal standards. And then the Indian guy just came and explained what they had adopted at the national level, and there was a very, very strict regime on lascivious material. I don't know what lascivious material in Europe
means
would
something
mean.
Something different in Europe.
Okay, so getting them together and finding the critical mass of actors that are willing to draft common procedures is probably useful.
Right. Okay, thanks. I'm going to hold questions a little bit and throw let Steve and Bob answer that, and then, wait a minute. Okay, go ahead. Okay.
And so, Julien and Bertrand, the notion of moving the day out of the country, by focusing on that, I said it's not a silver bullet, and we just need to understand how easy that bullet is to disable. Because while I would never want to create silos that don't already exist, the referee is the only guy on the field with a whistle. And in the case of what we've seen in a few instances, the ultimate whistle for the referee called the government is to shut off access to that site, that external site. You said it yourself. So that if a company decides to take that data offshore, governments that control the input to the internet on their borders can easily, and they've done it many times, cut off access. Bob told some stories yesterday in the Dynamic Coalition
about
the ultimate leverage point, blowing the whistle and red carding your company and all of your websites. And when they red card all of your sites, that then what have you won? Your service is not available to any of the customers in that country. They're not getting email. Their websites are dark. They can't get onto blog sites. They can't participate in a social networking. Those customers will not be your customers for long. A 3-, 4-, 5-day outage. Look what a 3-day outage did to Skype 2 months ago. Devastating. So when that happens, as a tactic, it's very clear that other companies will see what happened to that early pioneer with all the arrows in his back, and that early pioneer has learned the lesson. The other companies will leave their data onshore. So we cannot make that to be the ultimate weapon. I just don't think it'll work.
Julien, I know you want to respond, but I don't want to make the entire discussion about data.
I wanted to get back to the idea of a multi-stakeholder process. And I wanted to ask Nick from Amnesty if he could go further with what was raised in the last panel that I saw, where you talked about human rights groups moving away from multi-stakeholder dialogues. I'm quite curious as to why that would be better and who, and if we move away from those kinds of dialogues, what are we moving towards? Are we moving towards simply the human rights groups lobbying governments with or without company support? What do you see as the correct route to making these changes that we're all in favor of?
Thanks. I think that NGOs have had an awful lot of experience over the last 10 years of being involved with companies and other organizations and governments in some cases too, around the creation of voluntary codes. And I think that the general assessment that's come out of that, when you look at all sorts of look at the voluntary principles on security, for example, one that we've been very involved in, is it takes up an awful lot of time and energy. It's an interesting process. It's good to sit around and discuss things, but at the end of the day, we're interested in outcomes. And this really goes back to what Julian was saying. We're not measuring this by how much we're all lined up to say we support freedom of expression. I'm sure we all agree we can sit around and we can discuss it, and that's great. But is it actually going to change anything on the ground? And the experience of the last 10 years in terms of numerous voluntary initiatives is that it doesn't really change very much on the ground. And if we're linking it into this one specifically, I agree with Julian. I think that the test for us is, does it change the case of Xi Tao if it happened again? And not just Xi Tao, it's the case of censorship as well, taking stuff down from sites. If we look at what's been happening in the last year, we can have the discussion again about Thailand and the king in Thailand. We can talk about Yahoo and Microsoft signing the Chinese pledge on self-discipline again a few months ago. We can talk about Yahoo doing everything it can to block the case of Xi Tao's relatives gaining some sort of redress for what happened in the courts in the United States. And so, you know, what worries us is we're sitting down with companies in good faith and whatever, but at the same time, nothing that's actually happening outside of those meetings seems to be any different. And if it isn't any different, we need to find a different way of doing it. And I think that what we're generally moving towards is a set of enforceable standards at an international level, which covers a whole range of human rights, not just about freedom of expression here. The reason we are still committed to this process is because we hope what's going to come out of it at the end of the day will move us towards that. We hope it will create a set of principles that ultimately we can get enforced internationally. And that's important because, you know, even if this process is completely successful and we work together with Google and Yahoo and Microsoft and Vodafone over the next 10 years, and that's going to make a difference to people on the ground, there's an awful lot of companies that doesn't include. We haven't even begun, and you know, we're talking about the referee having a whistle and so on. There are some companies, probably not the ones around the table, that are even more powerful. If you look at the actual hardware companies who governments do rely upon to do the censoring and so on, and we're not even close to getting them into the process yet. So it's going to take more than this initiative and the people that are chosen to really get us to the stage that we want to get to in the end. And we see this as one small part, but you know, we know the problems from previous experiences.
Which one of these is working. The one thing that I will say is I don't think anybody participating in this process thinks it's the answer. I think they see it as bringing a set of actors together to help companies move in the right direction. I think we'd be foolish to think, you know, given the complexity of this issue, that we have an answer. Mark, did you want to add to that? And then I want to talk a little bit about the question of responsible company practices. Julian, you will get your turn.
No,
you're deferring to your colleague.
I'm deferring to Julian.
I won't talk about data retention. Don't worry.
No more data retention. I want to know whether you lobbied against data retention in Europe, and then we can talk.
No, because the feeling I had is, you said whether, basically, if you disagree with that the Chinese say or what the Thai, you know, governments wants you to do, they'll just simply block your website. So you have no other option. I think that's more, you know, that's not that easy. For example, Yahoo has their servers in China, they're open. Google has Gmail outside. As far as I know, Gmail is accessible in China. Am I correct? Gmail.
Until they decide to block it, yeah.
Gmail is accessible in China, right?
Not usually, no.
Well, I'm in contact with people using Gmail every day. Well, that's a subtle way of saying.
Well, there was a decision made when we entered China not to offer services such as.
A decision made when we entered China not to offer services such as Gmail and Blogger, which could put us in the position of having to turn over IP addresses to the Chinese government. That was an affirmative decision made by the company because we wanted to draw a line.
Yes, that's exactly what I say. You have your servers outside China. You have Gmail accessible in China, and I know that because people send me Gmail emails every day from China, and you didn't comply, you don't not collaborate with the Chinese authorities, and you don't help them to nail people. So that's possible. I mean, it's possible to have compromised.
Well, let me just raise something, Julian, because I mean, you know, I'm very supportive of Google's decisions there, but you could also see a circumstance, and then I'm gonna move from you to other people in the room, where responsible companies simply, I mean, Microsoft has thousands, hundreds of thousands of blog sites, and they've had to make some actually fairly minimal compromises about sort of what the blogs say, make it a little harder to get to. But in return, thousands upon thousands of blogs exist. So, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, they also have Chinese company to provide exactly the same service. You can have Baidu provide access to search engine,
right.
And you can also have a Chinese email account. So if it's just that, leave it to the Chinese. They'll provide the same service. If you have American companies, you can expect that they have higher standards. If they don't, what's the point of having them in China?
All right. One thing I don't want to do is make this about China, because this process has been a process. I mean, Telesonera is involved in this process because they're moving into Eastern Europe and into the BRIC countries and into India and Russia. And French Telecom has its own concerns, and it's not about China. So I think it's very important for people to understand that we're trying to come up with a solution that is not binary, that is not here are the 10 things you do. It is here is the process you engage in to try to make better decisions. And there is an entire section of these principles which has the boring title of responsible company practices, which binds these companies in very detailed ways to changing their internal processes, their decision making, down to the person on the ground. And I want to talk a little bit about that, because part of that is based on a commitment to do serious human rights risk assessment when entering new markets or launching new products and services. I think that's an important commitment. Again, at the end of the day, there's not a chart that says, and when you find X, you do Y, when you find Z, you do ABC. I'm interested in folks' reaction to the human rights risk assessment. I will say, in response to Julian, without revealing confidences, that there are indeed companies in this process who have already begun to do human rights risk assessments in entering new markets. Is that successful? Do we know whether these principles at the end of the day will have an impact? I think the answer is we don't, and we won't for some time. We will hopefully turn more companies into responsible citizens. Whether or not at the end of the day we'll prevent every Shatao case, I don't think any of us are powerful enough to make that happen. Do folks want to talk a bit about the risk assessment concept? Steve, you want to start that off?
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic idea, but it's also a missed opportunity. And the good news is that it's early enough in the principles development that we could expand it. The way the principles read today is that it calls upon the participating companies to become familiar with the relevant local laws in a market, and then do an assessment as to whether those laws conform or don't conform with the international rule of law and human rights principles. Sort of a legal opinion on whether they comply. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. I think to really be helpful to an e-commerce company, to a company doing business in a regime like that, is to then extend that to suggest what are the areas of risk for users of online communication services. And if not the companies themselves, but rather some single body, I think these principles call for the creation of a governance structure, a governance body. Get the folks in this room who are around the table and CDT and BSR to create a governance body, and the governance body should do these risk assessments. They get that legal opinion and then put it in the hands of a company, because I remember companies that will take that risk assessment and then translate it in terms that their users and customers can understand. Again, focusing on that, right?
One of the concerns, I have one working and one unworking, and they've now become merged, is that ultimately we would like to make these principles accessible and valuable to small companies, and you know, simply the obligations and the responsible practices section is actually fairly heavy lifting. It's not just cosmetic, and the constant conversation in this group is high. You want a high bar because you want this to be real. You want a big tent, and the question is how do you balance that? And I know that you've expressed concern about there needing to be more support centralized in order to help small companies participate in the process.
I think you're exactly right. The bigger the tent, the more support we're going to be able to build. But remember this, one of the groundbreaking applications like YouTube and some of the original blog sites, they actually started as tiny little startup companies, you know, where the company furniture was a beanbag, and the general counsel was somebody's brother-in-law. There's no way that they would have gone to the work of doing this human rights risk assessment, much less have adopted the internal procedures necessary to implement this. So small firms will look to the governance structure that I hope you'll create to get the whole process started by giving a risk assessment, and then that little startup, tomorrow's YouTube, can put on their privacy warnings front and center on their product. Users of this product, you need to be extremely careful in this country with the use of the following words and phrases and the pictures that could be construed to offend will cause our service to go dark and endanger your freedom. So those kind of warnings are essential. But then over time, let's suppose a regime begins to change its laws. We need there's governance structure to tell us all about the changes, because there's no way that the small firms will be able to monitor the changes and update our site.
I will say that part of the notion of the governance structure is to have, you know, it be multi-stakeholder, but also to make sure that there's an opportunity that there are sessions with people who are experts in countries and markets, and that there's a constant exchange of ideas and information about where things are going, almost in an advisory capacity to the group. Let me ask one comment, and then I'm going to ask another hard question, which somewhat goes back to Julien's point, but without Yahoo in the room, I'd like to talk about it without Yahoo.
Just one comment on the human rights assessment. Those assessments have to be carried out by the human rights groups and the socially responsible investors, NGOs of all sorts, but not the companies. Because if we do it, then nobody will believe us. And that's a role that I think that the rest of civil society can play in this process, and a very important role.
Thank you. You know what, I had a couple of questions in the audience, so before I ask the complicated question about how you bind partners to the principles, do you want to ask your question? You certainly, yeah. You want to?
My name is Robert Kosak. I come from the ILO, the International Labor Organization.
Right.
I would like to start
this for translation purposes.
I would like to start my comment remembering history. 100 years ago, many countries in the world found that countries were undermining each other by creating lower and lower labor standards, and nobody was being able to survive under those conditions. So the international community set itself up a minimal number of standards so that competition to create a level playing field. That level playing field is necessary in a number of circumstances. The internet and the enterprises that are in a global information society are facing an exactly similar problem. You have to face the level playing field. And by creating association of enterprises, you are not competing in a level playing field. You can create as many standards and as many voluntary norms, but if there are no common minimum standards, every time you encounter difficulties concerning human rights, you have two choices: leave the market to the competition or lower your own standards. And therefore, ultimately, one of the strategies that you have to adopt is go to a global fora that sets minimum standards so that people can compete in a level playing field. That does not mean that you cannot ensure particular practices. The other area of importance is a question of enforcement. If you, as enterprises, wish to be able to compete, you have to count on the global community provided, among others, by the internet and by active partners can and ensure that there is a level playing field, right? So, for example, in labor, as I was saying this morning, if you have a factory in China that employs children, no matter what laws are applied in China or in Turkey or in Tunisia or wherever you want, that factory will be closed thanks to the pressure of the civil society. Therefore, I believe that the sort of initiatives that have to be taken to ensure freedom of expression, freedom of access, privacy, are ones that have to be go farther than enterprises. Finally, finally, to complete and terminate, I am surprised that, and it's standard, unfortunately, in your country, workers do not belong to any of your organizations.
If the governments all agreed to the same human rights standards, we wouldn't have this problem. Have you been to Turkey? Have you been to Tunisia? Have you been to? Forgive me.
There's a microphone right there.
The fact that there is no compliance today to a certain number of rules does not imply that the rules are bad. The compliance and the methods of enforcing those rules have to change. For example, a number of rules concerning association and freedom of expression concerning labor are being violated in a number of countries. Mm. And it is the fact that some companies, civil society, and a number of governments throughout the world using trade agreements are being able to modify practices gradually, that is ensuring a level playing field.
Many of us strongly support the notion of using trade as a leverage point. Let me ask, because Bertrand, is that? Sure, absolutely. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not seeing the back of the room.
Unless there's another question. Just one remark about the human rights assessment. I endorse the fact that if it's made by company, it's a problem. I would even go further. The formulation that was used almost seemed to mean that the companies were basically making a constitutional judgment about the appropriateness of national regulations, right, regarding higher principles. This is great, but it may be going a bit far. The point I wanted to make is actually to revert some of the procedures that are being chosen, and I've mentioned that in another forum. I'm surprised that knowing that social networking sites are now aggregating 50 million people or, right, 100 million actors, why not revert the procedure and think about governance frameworks within those sites that would associate the users or the customers? I like the fact that Facebook, for instance, is describing itself as a social utility. In a certain way, I see it as a community that is self-governing, right, progressively. What about exploring codes and governance frameworks that are within such companies or such communities, and associate governments, civil rights activists, the customers or the users, and the application developers for Facebook to develop something that is framed? For instance, on hate speech, I can imagine that the community, even if in the US hate speech is absolutely open, maybe the community will say, we don't want it that much. And in the internal framework, this is not in. It's terms of service, it's agreed or not, right. I don't know.
Yeah, right now it's terms of, I think it's mostly terms in service. Terms of service, right, rather than agreements. But but the question of collaborative development of norms, I think, is sort of the next big thinking and procedures. And it's, I've had some interesting conversations with Second Life about that question. I know there's a, whatever reason, where I'm sitting, I can't see whoever's back there asking a question. And then I have sort of two questions that ought to leave us busy until the end of the hour.
My name is Andrew Mack. I have a small firm based in Washington, so I'm really in touch with the small firm issues. And we work with a lot of countries around the world. And I guess one of the things I wanted to emphasize or ask Steve maybe to bring out a little bit more, this idea of making these standards, any standards that are created, accessible to small business.
Right.
I am the principal of my company. I am also the chief legal advisor of my company. I'm in charge of finances. I mean, we're five people. So it's
a beanbag?
No, we don't have a beanbag. We actually have chairs. But not that many. And the point of it is that especially if you're working in multiple markets around the world, if we want to get a lot of people in, you know, 80-some percent of the companies in the United States are small businesses, right? If we want to get a lot of companies in, create this kind of the mass that you're talking about, the community that you're talking about, then we have to make it easy for small companies that don't have the ability to do a constant refresh of this page and know all the rules in all the different countries but want to do the right thing. We have to make that possible for them. I would also stress, having worked in a past life for the World Bank, that it's not just the initial assessment that you have to do, which can be long and involved and take a lot of time and careful consideration. It's that ongoing process that's often trickier because governments change, rules change. Sometimes they change three or four times a year. So anything you can do to make that easier for smaller firms to get involved, I think that will help.
The feedback helps. It's an ongoing debate, and without having necessarily enough small companies directly saying that, it's a voice that hasn't been, I think, adequately heard in the process. Got two closing questions. Oh, okay, please. You can take. You gonna bring it up, Dave?
Hi, my name is Graziella Tanaka, and I'm from Avaz.org. We're a global activist online community. And I just came from the other session, which was on the fundamental human rights on the internet. And it struck me how much both sessions were so focused on corporate accountability as opposed to government accountability. And I know you touched a little bit towards that topic at the end of the session, but it seems to me that the multi-stakeholder approach is more of a long term, while we are always, you know, as human rights organizations, thinking of short term process and how, you know, we're working right now with people, pro-democracy groups in Burma, so we know we've been trying to deal a lot with these issues of censorship, and we're also working with some Egyptian bloggers right now that, you know, have been going through a long struggle of incarceration, many of them. And I was wondering if you can touch at least a little bit, I don't know if this is a discussion for another session, like the Internet Bill of Rights, but I was just hoping to hear a little bit more about how to make governments accountable and what kind of pressure points are worked on a short-term basis to resolve these immediate problems of human rights.
Mark, do you want to respond to that? And then I'll tell you what the principles say about bringing companies into that process. But I think we should.
The governments, for the most part, are held accountable by numerous international conventions and Universal Declaration of Human Rights, et cetera, from 1948 on, 1966. So the documents are there, but to try to force a government to comply, good luck. I mean, it is very tough. We constantly remind governments of their responsibilities in this field. organizations such as Committee to Protect Journalists write hundreds of letters every year to governments, reminding them of their responsibilities in human rights and to protect journalists and for freedom of expression. Even the most repressive governments that I know of have within their constitution the protection of freedom of expression and freedom of the press and all those kinds of things. And you go to those governments and you sit down with the Minister of Justice and Human Rights in one particular country, and he said, but we have complete freedom of the press. We have complete freedom of expression. And then they read to you from a publication, a newspaper, and which I couldn't understand because it was in Arabic, but there was an Arabic person with us who understood from Egypt, Sally Sammy, if you know Sally. And it was critical of the government. And I said, that's fantastic. You finally have a newspaper that dares to criticize you. What's the name of the paper, please? And he gave it to us. And we left and went kiosk to kiosk to kiosk throughout the city. And the kiosk people said, what newspaper? Never heard of it. So, I mean, again, they understand their responsibilities such that they try to trick us into believing that they're complying with their responsibility and that there is freedom of the press and freedom of expression. It doesn't exist. We do put enormous effort on, but it's difficult. We're just little groups, and
Rob,
we try hard.
Rob, I'm going to ask you to respond, and then I want to just reiterate something in the principles that actually think is I know I can't hold on to this thing. I'm used to the little ones that fit in. I know. Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, it's mine. I think one of the places we need to start looking is just a reflection back on Burma. I think many of us were shocked but not surprised when they shut down the internet. And the lesson that I came away with from that was that the economic and the social and the political costs for the junta of doing so there were not high enough. And this is one of the long-term strategic goals, is to make the internet an essential social, economic, and political part of every country around the world, such that the costs for governments in taking these kinds of extreme actions are way too high for them to proceed. And that's really a long-term vision that I think everyone's on board with that, certainly, and that this multi-stakeholder group can really help to push in many ways that are probably not immediately obvious, but very, very important. I think that's one of the values of this group.
To give a very practical example of that, we have spoken to the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which was the Bush administration's foreign aid invention, a new body that gives out a great deal of foreign aid in the United States to countries that meet certain criteria. And we have lobbied them to include internet freedom in that criteria so that U.S. aid does not go to countries that do not have internet freedom. Now, have we gotten our way yet? No, but we will continue to lobby in those things so that regimes do pay.
And I will say, as unsuccessful as that has been, that has been one of the collaborative efforts about how we could use the power of our companies. And that is, obviously, the power of the purse all around the world is one thing. Trade is another. The one thing that I find very valuable, as I said early on, in the principles, is the commitment, and we will see how it develops over time, to bring these large multinational internet companies into the advocacy side of this. And, you know, you're all my friends, but I'm skeptical of that one from my own experience. I'm going to put one last question on the table, and I think it's a critical one because, and it's one that we're having the hardest time with, which is, what does accountability look like going forward? If we are able to come to an agreement on what a corporate set of principles and, you know, more companies are willing to become involved in this process, and we're able to set up this governance group and do the level of international outreach that we hope we will be able to do over time, how do you develop a credible, meaningful, measurable, and verifiable compliance regime here? You know, we have similar accords in the labor area in which you know, there are monitors who go into the factory and you can tell whether or not, you know, and you can talk to people and know whether they're paid or whether the doors are blocked. It's a very different circumstance, and it has become, I think, a very complicated and somewhat contentious issue about what is possible or feasible in this space. Bob, do you want to talk about that, lead off this? And frankly, anybody in the audience who wants to talk about this, we're all ears.
As Leslie said, this has proved to be an incredibly difficult set of discussions. From the company viewpoint, doing this, it's hard to compare to, for example, to the fair labor idea when you can walk onto a factory floor. Because the question of what do you measure to begin with is a very difficult question to answer. If you agree that you're going to measure a certain number of cases each year, a certain number of times that a company is asked to give information to a government, a certain number of sites that a company is asked to shut down, or keywords that a company is asked to use to shut down, how do you determine which ones those are going to be? Because those change literally every day. And the number of cases, we're not allowed to tell you, in large part because when it's national security, it's against the law in almost every country for us to say that it's a national security case to begin with. Now, I know that's a catch-22, but it's also the truth. We have other problems that we're encountering. The proprietary nature of how we do these things and how we and our files themselves. It's doubtful that our lawyers, any lawyer for any company, are going to allow third parties into the intricacies of our files on this. There are also questions that we face about privacy and whether or not by giving up certain files we're actually threatening people's privacy more than we would be if we didn't. And finally, there are practical questions. This is an enormous amount of work if you do it in the way that people have suggested it be done. Simply to go through every year and pick out those cases and so forth, we'll have to add staff people just to comply with that one part of the principles. So we look at this, and I think the place to start on an optimistic note is with a process to make sure that the way that we look at each of these cases is at least in keeping with the principles that we've agreed to, and that there are certain parts of our companies that are devoted to not only making sure that things are carried out the way we said we would carry them out, but also to training our own employees so that they know what to look out for and that they know how to react in certain cases.
Rob and then
Steve. I guess I want to reiterate the slipperiness of accountability in this context. What the principals are doing is asking companies to do everything they can to try and enforce freedom of expression around the world, subject to the constraints, the legal constraints of governments around the world, which are unknown. So how do we evaluate that? Well, that becomes very difficult because we can't observe it. I guess for me, the value of this initiative and the measure of the success is when the group acts as a whole to enact, to put into place minimum standards someplace, and that's painful somewhat for all the participants.
I think that what we would ideally measure is outcomes. That's all any of us really care about. Like, would Shertal be in prison right now? That would be a different outcome under principles. So outcomes are all we care about. But unfortunately, as Bob indicated, the outcomes about when companies have pushed back and resisted to requests from a government are often opaque. We're not allowed to share it.
Or they're not good.
Or perhaps the results are not good and there's not a desire to share it. So if you can't truly measure outcomes sufficiently, what do you do next? Well, what we usually do is check on effort, level of effort, as a proxy for outcomes. But we wouldn't give up on that. There are ways the companies will be able to produce cases, perhaps by redacting some data or showing cases where we've successfully pushed back.
Where they can.
Where we can, exactly. Where we're allowed to share it, exactly. And that will help to show that there are some successful outcomes here, focusing a little more on the successes than failures. But if you are going to look at effort, a good deal of the effort is transparent to the world. You can go to the website for that new blog site that just came up in China and see what kind of terms of use they're displaying for their users, what kind of warnings they give users about the content, pictures, and communications that they use. That's transparent to the world. And then the in-between level of effort is what Bob described. How hard are they training employees? What are they telling employees to do in terms of the procedures to resist and challenge? And what are the procedures manuals look like, and are they following it? Now, that's not transparent because that's inside of Google or inside of Yahoo. But then again, it's not opaque. By asking for it, the companies will produce that if they're confident that it won't be shared widely. Because each company will have its own procedures that it wants to track, and it's happy to share it for a compliance purpose, but it wouldn't necessarily want it disclosed to competitors.
Do we have any comments on this question from the group? I realize that we're sort of coming to the end of our hour, but frankly, This has been our hardest question to answer. So, yeah, all right. So I think maybe Breton? And then I'll give everybody a chance if they want to make a closing.
Just want to share one specific case that has been given to me here of the leverage of aid to enforce or implement things. For instance, when we are helping some developing countries, especially in Africa, to set up automated filing system for law enforcement, for police, and so on, one of the key criteria that we put in is that they have a data protection authority, and if they don't have it, they implement it. And there's a huge push. I mean, Marie-Georges here is from the French CNIL, which is the data protection authority in France. And there's a huge program in coordination with the French Foreign Ministry in promoting the development of data protection authorities in countries that we have aid with. Another element is actually the anonymization of requests. There is a possibility to have a log of the number of requests that have been made. Of course, you don't reveal that there has been a security request on that issue for that purpose by that actor at that time. But if there is something that can allow to put a meter, for instance, and you can even say that there is a good behavior by a government that is below a certain threshold, and anything that is below the threshold, you're in the green zone. But if you're getting a little bit higher, then, wow, it's getting into the orange zone, and then in the red one that we've been accustomed to in the past few years for other types of alerts. So maybe this kind of anonymity, but logging the interaction, having protocols for identifying types of requests is maybe an avenue.
Right, and indeed that is one of the, I think, areas where we have some accord is on the development of this kind of data, which of course, you know, ONI and others really, you know, would find extremely valuable. Of course. So let me give everybody an opportunity to close. As I said, we're in this situation where we cannot sort of distribute the principles to 3,000 people and have 3,000 editors. I am trying to have some individual conversations, particularly with people who represent governments. I am willing to sit down with people with the piece of paper. And actually would welcome doing that to the extent schedules permit. You can find me around here. Bob, you want to close?
As imperfect a process as this has been, I think that it's been very valuable in any number of areas. In particular, in putting people at the same table and having them listen to each other, people who haven't listened to each other in a fairly rational way previously. The one request that I would have is that more companies become involved in this process. Companies who are in this sector and who currently don't want to participate. Because the more companies that participate, even if you don't believe that this kind of multi-stakeholder forum is the way to go, they will certainly have a greater impact in more countries and eventually lead to the kinds of international standards that I think the human rights groups are most in favor of.
I know I was supposed to say that, and I'm glad you did.
Couple reflections on the process. I see this one as one that has a huge potential upside if a wide variety, a diversity of voices coming across business and civil sector and even governments can speak as one, that could certainly have a tremendous impact. We also recognize the complexity of this endeavor and that it has a real chance of failure. But I think that as long as the process continues and people are talking, there's still the real chance of success, and that it'll be very hard to predict when and where that will occur. So
and what the final product will look like.
Absolutely.
Steve?
I'll try to address Graciela's question. You said, well, why aren't we focusing more on government accountability instead of corporate accountability? Well, the parties to this agreement, as it is now, if it becomes an agreement, are human rights groups and corporations. So that's why we were focusing on it.
Socially responsible investors.
Socially responsible
and
investors.
Free press
but,
groups.
But the ultimate ideal, and you brought it up, sort of the gentleman from ILO, the ultimate ideal would be if there could be other points of pressure brought on companies, on the countries, to change the regimes and adhere to internationally recognized norms. If that were to happen, then a lot of this is not necessary. But what do they say? Sometimes you need belts and suspenders. And I think these principles are like the suspenders part. Let's try to get countries to change the regimes, but just in case they don't, or if they promise to but they're really not, companies need tools that they can use to push back, to challenge. And I still think that these are well worth developing. And I'll close by saying I'm relatively optimistic that we actually can prevail in the long run, because I think if you look at apartheid, that was a system of limiting rights. But it was doomed to fail, not necessarily out of the pressure of other countries, but because the business and citizens inside of South Africa realized this was not going to be a long-term policy that was going to work for them. And I have to think that when Burma shuts down the entire internet for 3 or 4 days, or nations try to shut off an entire site, that they'll start to convince their own citizens and businesses that go dark option is no way for a long-term policy. So the more and more that nations employ the shut down the internet concept, the less likely it is to be a tool in the long run. So I think we can prevail by increasing the pain point that's felt inside of those nations.
It's about pain. That's
right. I agree with everything that's been said, that there's just so much that can be done with meeting with the SRIs, with the HR groups, with the free press groups, and with companies. We certainly support this project. I think that none of us on this panel would be involved with it if we thought it would end up in nothing, or that it would end up in failure. I believe that it will succeed. It will be 100% successful. I doubt it, but it will certainly be successful. And we certainly agree that there ought to be no more Shintao cases. But when there are dozens and dozens of bloggers and journalists in jail around the world, jailed by governments who prefer not to have freedom of expression and freedom of the press, we must all place as much pressure as possible on those governments to release and to restore to former grandness and greatness these courageous people who risk their lives around the world. You do know, don't you, that this, besides soldier, the second most dangerous job in the world is a periodista, a journalist. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. I think the goal is to see whether they've already taken lunch away, so.